All right, well, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
We had our last installment of this when we covered Numbers 10. Today we're going to move over to Numbers 11. And the events here will cause us to consider some things about our fleshly desires, as well as considering some things about the Spirit of God and the Spirit in man. Before we go there, though, I do want to slightly go back to Numbers 10 for a moment and set the stage and the context for coming into chapter 11. If you recall, we only covered the first 10 verses of chapter 10 because we're focusing on the words of Yeshua and of Yehovah, and what we discussed, of course, was the silver trumpets. In my Bible, between verses 10 and 11, there's, you know, how they sometimes they put these headings in there, and it says Israel leaves Sinai, and it was, and it's appropriate because that's where we're at. It's a good description because in those verses, we do see that the cloud is taken up, which was a signal for what? For them to pack up and move. And in the rest of those verses, we get a lot of information about the names of the head of the armies. And so, you know, they're leaving in the same. We already talked about how they left in groups and all of that. And that's all kind of laid out there, and we see them doing what they're told to do, and so they've started traveling. They begin traveling, and we're going to pick this up in verse 33. It says, "So they departed from the mountain of the Lord on a journey of 3 days, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them." Now, I want you to remember that 3 days. "And the cloud of the Lord was above them by day, and they went out from the camp. So it was, whenever the ark was set out, that Moshe said, 'Rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you.' And when it rested, he said, 'Return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel.'" So they're traveling. They're on their journey to the promised land. And Moshe would pray to Yehovah in the morning for protection, as well as to be with them, you know, through the night. Now remember too that the cloud was with them the whole time. Okay, the cloud traveled with them. Yehovah's presence was visible to them all the time. And so with that in mind, now we're going to turn to chapter 11. And just remember, the only reason there's a chapter is so that we can find places easy, right? There's no artificial break here. So we go right from this, "Return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel." And so what's happening is they're on their way, and Moshe is praying over them morning and night, and they're on their way. Okay, so God has given all of these instructions on how to be his nation. The priesthood's in place, the tabernacle's built, all of that. And then they just got these silver trumpets that would instruct them in how and when they're to move and that kind of thing. Okay, so Yehovah has shown them, you know, all of this power that he has and his faithfulness and all of this. And now they're going to travel through this wilderness to the place that this same God that has demonstrated all of this power says that you're going to, and you're really going to love it, right? So Moshe has this very optimistic and joyful attitude concerning their journey. And then the very next verse, Numbers 11, verse 1, "Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused. So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp. Now that was quick. Remember, I ask you to remember, how long had they been traveling? 3 days. It's just been 3 days, right? And, you know, they're on their way to this promised great land, and it, just in 3 days, they're complaining. It's amazing how we in our flesh can have so little patience for God. I think about the disciples not being able to stay awake long enough to pray with Yeshua in his time of need, right? You know, you get that in Matthew 26. He came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "What, could you not watch with me an hour? Watch and pray lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing." It's willing, but the flesh is weak. Flesh is weak. So little patience. They couldn't watch an hour. And these people couldn't travel 3 days without complaining. So before we go and judge them for this, I want to take a moment. And then, by the way, today's going to be kind of a split sermon. Okay? I'm going to introduce this for the first half, and then we're going to have a shorter message on the second half. But anyway, I want to reflect a moment on our own lives, our own responses to stress and trials. If you're anything like me, you go through these undulations of faith and fear. In trials, I've had times where I feel so strong and so safe and so connected with my Father that nothing phases me, especially when I'm, you know, on my knees before Him. But then so quickly my flesh can succumb to the fear of trial and begin to complain. And complain about, you know, circumstances. Even when, as it often is, the circumstances are my own fault, you know. So we can go from strength in the spirit to weakness in the flesh very quickly. This is that tug of war that we talk about between the Spirit of God given to us and placed into us and the spirit in man that just succumbs to these fleshly lusts, right? So we fail. And our failures are largely connected to our will and our vision. Okay, the Bible says where there is no vision, the people perish, right? So, and so our will can be manipulated and changed by our vision, right? So we don't like pain. We don't like discomfort. So we try to avoid it. But think about it. Sometimes we engage in things that we know are going to be painful, that we know are going to be stressful or uncomfortable because we see the end result as being worth it. People outside any relationship with God do the same thing. It's called goal setting, right? You set a goal. That's vision. Say, okay, I'm gonna work through the pain to get to that, right? We do it all the time. And so sheer will can drive us through that pain. The spirit in man can have a strong will to get them through adversity. But when it's weak, which is often the case, we tend to resort to complaining and failure. On the flip side, when we set our weak will aside and engage in the strong will of God and His Spirit, well, it strengthens us, it bolsters us, and it gives us the strength to push through if we'll follow it, if we'll let it, right? And this was Moshe's joyful attitude in the midst of the journey. Why? Because he trusted you know, the Yehovah said, this land is going to be awesome. It's going to be great. It's going to be land flowing with milk and honey. Moshe had his eyes on that. And so that's where that joy and that strength, it came from. All right. So he was fully trusting Yehovah to get them where they needed to go. Even though it wasn't fun, it wasn't fun. But he was focused on the promise of God. What you need to realize is what these people were complaining about was real. I don't think it wasn't. I sat and thought about it, and I mean, it had to be a miserable time. Set yourself in I've been there. Set yourself in a barren, and I mean, I'm talking barren, where you look out and you don't see anything green but maybe little twigs sticking up and rocks and hills. Can you imagine traveling through that on foot with children, with your elderly parents? You know, no paved streets. That's not what this was. And you've got, you know, and I've been, like I say, there's no grass. It's how much dust and stuff is being kicked up by 2 or 3 million people, you know, trudging along, and you're square in the middle of it. This was not fun, okay? It was not fun. You know, it was bad. Nothing about it was pleasant. You know, the nights around there many times get below freezing at night and gets over 100 degrees in the daytime. There was just nothing good about this, right? Except for where they were going. Now, verse 1 here says that the people complained. It doesn't say about which of these things they complained about. It was most likely, it was probably all of it. Some got more complaints over the rough terrain, while others got more complaints about, well, what are we eating, and, you know, on and on. So it was probably a little bit of everything. What's really bad about this, though, is that they complained to Yehovah. They blamed it on him. As we read then, the Lord's anger was aroused, and the fire of the Lord burned among them. And some in the outskirts of the camp were destroyed. So I looked up fire. It's from Strong's H784, and it is the same fire, the same word, along with brimstone that was, you know, laid down onto Sodom and Gomorrah and destroyed them. So I kind of see this then as fiery judgment. It was judgment through fire. So this is a fire of judgment. He judged them for this complaining right on the spot. And that, guys, is where my first rabbit trail started in looking at this. And there was too many of them to fit in one message. So we're going to do a little bit of it. But anyway, I had to admit, have you ever complained to God? I have. I've complained. I've been, you know, that way. I've been upset about things that I didn't think was fair, wondering why God allowed it or caused it. Yet I'm still here and I'm breathing. And they're not, some of them. Why? What's the difference? What was the difference about my complaining and their complaining? I had to ask myself this. I'm like, why? I mean, if they're complaining and the fire of the Lord burnt among them and destroyed some of them, why am I still standing? It made me dig into the Hebrew word meant by complaining. What you're looking at is the Hebrew for Hebrews or for Numbers 11:1. Now, I don't read Hebrew, you know that. But I can compare letters. I can look at them and see what is there compared to what I'm seeing in like my Strong's Concordance, right? When it breaks down the verses, okay? Well, like this. So when you look up Hebrews 11:1, you're going to get this. You're going to see where the words are, the Hebrew, that those words are translated from. Like this word, it's Yehovah, right? For Lord. Okay. So in this case, just looking up this word, which is complained, this 596, it didn't really help much because all I got was this. I looked it up and it said, well, this word for complain over here is this Hebrew word anon. Now, I don't know enough about Hebrew to explain why. Well, I guess I do. They take the Hebrew symbols and they kind of translate those to letters. You'll see this kind of in a minute. But all I get out of this is, okay, well, it says complain, murmur. So how does that help me? How is that any different than my complaining? It didn't help me at all. Okay? There's nothing here to distinguish between my stupid complaining and the complaining that these people did that aroused the Lord to anger, that said, I need to judge them right now, and sent fire down. Is there, so I went and I wanted to see, that's the reason that I pulled this up. I wanted to know, was there anything else before or after this that was more descriptive of complain? Okay? Because many times there are. There's little marks, and there's sometimes other little letters before or after that make it either a preposition or, you know, all these different things. So I looked at it, and this is from a Hebrew dictionary, okay, that takes what I showed you as the Hebrew writing and breaks that apart, okay? So when we get to this word complained, what do we see? We see this anam right here. That's what we saw in the concordance and the other deal I showed you. What is this? And if you remember back to the Strong's breakout, it was complain, Lord, right? Or displeased Lord. So we had people complained, displeased Yahweh. That's what we saw in the Strong's. But here we have, why isn't this in there? Because it's in the Hebrew, right? And what is this? So I did some more. The last part of that there is that anon that we saw in Strong's. The part before that, it means bitter. Bitter. So this was bitter complaining. That's okay. That helps some. But then I looked up this word raw. What's that mean? Evil. It's evil. So in our English Bibles, we read that people complained and it displeased God. But what it really means, this is a lot more than murmuring. This is bitter, evil complaining against God. Much different. So what you had was God in His goodness and His mercy having provided grace to get them out of bondage in Egypt and moving them to a place filled with milk and honey. This is God coming down intervening in the lives of a whole nation and providing all of this goodness and grace and mercy to them. And how has he responded to in this way? With bitter, evil complaining. So the Lord responded by eradicating the evil. You see, that's what God's in the business of doing. There is good, which is God, and there is evil. And things that are opposed to and against the goodness of God is evil. If you are against God, it's evil. And the Bible is telling us, the Hebrew is telling us, that they came against God in their words. They were against Him. Evil. Evil. And God, like I said, He's in the business of destroying evil. And He will be successful. At the end of the day, it will all be shut down. So we go to the next verse and we read that Moshe, he's mediator, right? Okay. He does his job. And he prays on the behalf of the people. Now, when the people complained, displeased the Lord, we got to go to the next one. Then the people cried out to Moses, and when Moshe prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. This should have sent a pretty big signal, I would think, to the camp not to rebel against God. He knows what He's doing. He's shown them nothing but grace, and He's demonstrated His power. By showing His power along with His grace should have been enough for them to trust in both of them. In other words, a loving, merciful God has the power to do what He says He's going to do. They were to believe in what He was doing because of His demonstrated power. But there were those on the outskirts of the camp that did not believe fully. They did not trust in that demonstrated power of God that they had seen. And so it couldn't see them through the trials and the circumstances of the journey, so they blamed God bitterly. It was, in effect, evil. Because, again, it's against God. They were not looking to God. They denied what God had promised them. And then they responded with this bitter, evil complaining. So see, it's one thing to complain and be discouraged about the journey. You know, that's your flesh is going to do that. But you still have to have trust that God can get you through it, and that God is going to get you through it. That He says, "I work everything out for good for those that love Him," right? So God is good all the time. And in verse 3, he named the place Taberah. That word means place of burning. So that's what that's about. It was in this place that some in the outskirts of the camp were burned. That was my next rabbi trail. That's where I went down for another long while. Why just the outskirts? Some people think this fire is lightning. Okay, lightning, and you know, whatever it hits, it catches on fire, and then there can be fires, right? Well, if you know, let's say it is lightning, let's say it's not, doesn't matter, God's all powerful. He could pluck people right out of individuals anywhere in there. Why was it the outskirts? Mixed multitude. Yes. Remember how when we looked at that tribe picture, you had the tabernacle in the middle and you had the tribes around. Okay, but you had a mixed multitude. And they were people that were not Benjamites or, you know, members of the family of Judah or what have you. They were all these people, as we've discussed, that were either in Egypt for business reasons or other things, and they decided, hey, we should hitch our wagon to these guys because their God's a little stronger than these other gods, right? But they weren't kind of, I guess, the same. right? Because you look at the next verse. Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? The mixed multitudes were the ones that left Egypt with the Hebrew people, but were not Hebrew. They wanted the benefits of being with them. And I would say, had I been in Egypt and not been a Hebrew, I might have hitched my wagon to them too, right? I mean, it's probably a good decision. But they weren't part of the tribes, so where did they camp? On the outskirts, right? So it was on the outskirts where this immediate judgment of fire came upon them, because even though they saw all these miracles, they did not trust the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to do what he said he was going to do. And so they responded with this bitter, evil speech that was against God. That's what we understand by this raw. The speech was against him. And that's a whole lot different than God, why are you doing this? I'm upset about it. You know, it's almost like cursing God, right? So I do suspect this was way beyond just grumbling. It was attacks on the character of God, questioning his ability to do what he said he was going to do. And that's evil. And that's why God started dealing with it. Because if not, that attitude would spread, wouldn't it, into his people, which it did here in verse 4. Look what it says. The mixed multitude, some of them, he didn't kill all of them, some were among them, and they were yielding to this craving of different food, and so then it crept into the children of Israel, and now they're wanting their taste buds satisfied. I'm not going to take time to read this. I put it in here. I didn't know I was going to go this long. Because I want to make room for this other message. But here we just hear them talking about what they had in Egypt. Yeah, we had spices and we had all this fish to eat because it was right by the Nile and everything was good, right? Verse 10 says, then Moshe heard the people weeping throughout their families, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was greatly aroused. Moses was also displeased. Were their eyes on God? They're going to a land filled with milk and honey. Do you think if they really believed that they could maybe endure for 3 days some more manna, knowing where they're going? If they really believe that? No. So now they're whining about what they're eating, okay, because their eyes weren't on God. And the point I want to make here before I conclude is that it's imperative that as we read these accounts, we take these things to heart and we apply them to our attitudes and our perspective today. Paul knew this. He was a student of Torah and he understood it. And I want you to listen as he explains this to the church at Corinth. He says, moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud. All passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moshe in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food. That's the manna. All drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. He's referring to the time when Moshe hit the rock and the water came out. They were baptized in the Red Sea. The cloud was over them. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples to the intent, for the purpose that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. In one day, 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, here it is, therefore he who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. What's the point? Well, if God dealt with this set apart people the way that he did, then why would it be any different later? This is a God that changes not. Are we somehow supposed to be immune to God's anger if we, in an evil, bitter manner, accuse him of not being fair, or our situation is his fault? Or even if it is his fault that he directed it, that we have the faith to understand that that's our journey to the promised land, that he's doing it for our good. Israel needed some perspective. They needed some vision. But they could not see past the day that they were in. They were not focused on the end result. It's why we talk so much about eternal perspective, a perspective of complete trust and confidence in God that does work everything for our good. But the opposite is still true for those who don't. That God was dealing with these Israelites and mixed multitude, it's the same today. Our current mainstream church will tell you a different story. They will explain that this Old Testament God is harsh, and that the new one, the new and improved God, is, you know, he's loving and merciful and gracious. They would teach us that there's no punishment for sin because Christ already took all the punishment, and yes, that's true, but it's applicable for those that follow him. That's why we read that, you know, not everyone says to me, Lord, Lord, but those that do what they're told. Family, there yet remains the severity of God. It is severity, though, that is given out in justice and complete wisdom, and it's only poured out as a last resort, for his heart is to bring everyone, if all possible, to his heart and his family. There is both severity and the perfect kindness of God. Paul, when speaking about the Gentiles being grafted into Israel, he said this. He said, therefore, consider the goodness and severity of God. On those who fell, severity, but toward you, goodness. Now, mainstream will stop right there and put a sentence. They won't read the rest of it, especially this next little word. If you continue in his goodness. Otherwise, you also will be cut off. So when we consider all this complaining we read of in Numbers 11 and onward, we need to use this example as a reminder to continually be monitoring our vision and our perspective, and looking to the future in our walk with God. We are to be trusting and confident in what God is doing, regardless of the circumstances around us. Because when we fail to do that, it's a lack of faith. It's like seeing all those miracles that they saw that led them out of Egypt, and then not being able to see that he's leading them to somewhere, you know, and just abandoning them in the desert. Paul is telling us to make sure that we don't do those same things. These events are there for us to learn from and not make the same mistakes. We left off in Numbers, right here. I don't know why it says 11:10. Well, I guess, yeah, it does. That Moses was displeased. the Lord was greatly aroused, and that after hearing all these complaints about the travel, the harsh terrain, the food, blah, 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 right? They were upset. Moshe then begins to really voice his frustration to Yehovah. And we're going to get into this next week. This is where we're going to pick up. He begins to voice his frustration to Yehovah, which led to the words and instruction that God gave him. And that's this series. We're looking at what God says, and I had to say all this to get the context to what's going on, because Moshe's going to voice his frustration here in a minute, and Yehovah is going to respond to that in word and deed. He's going to tell Moshe a couple things, and he's going to tell him what to do. And embedded in that is some really interesting things. We're going to touch on multiple things, and it was going to be too much to do in the time that I have left. So rather than make a huge long deal out of it, I'm going to stop here for now. We're going to pick this up next week, right after this, and go from there.